tsunami's back, bitches.
Took you long enough.
This has been an experience we will never forget.
This ain't no time to go all mushy.
Don't lecture me. I've waited long enough.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 453 of the Tsunami Escape Podcast. I am C. Kohler, and with me tonight is Seda.
Hello.
And Crocodile.
Hello.
Welcome back to another week of Tsunami. We obviously have some interesting news to discuss. We were talking just moments before about how much we want to talk about this, because there's a lot up in the air right now, but it's worth mentioning. So I'll kind of start out with the basics, and you guys can elaborate more if you want. But the basics, big news item, is that Netflix has made a bid to purchase the Warner Brothers side of the Warner Brothers Discovery business. Now, like we had talked about before, Warner Brothers and the Discovery parts of their business are planned to basically separate. And the Discovery portion includes the cable networks, which includes Cartoon Network, Adult Swim, and ultimately Toonami. And the Netflix bid that went out was only for the Warner Brothers part of it, not for the Discovery part of it. So it seems like they were going to get that. However, news that's happened today is that a counter bid has been placed out there by Paramount, who wants to purchase the entire thing. But there isn't a lot of, from what I'm hearing, that doesn't seem as likely to happen. So that's kind of where we're at.
Yeah, you basically said it how I understand it. And, you know, even if Warner Brothers, like, accepts the offer, it still has to go through, like, the government for regulation checks if it's allowed. So, at least as I understand it, I don't. None of us are experts on this. So, there's a couple different avenues that this can take. If Netflix bid goes through, then, like, what happens to the Discovery half? You know, does that have to be purchased by someone else? Or do they run their own thing? Or what? And if Paramount goes through, you know, who knows what their plans are? So, if there's no matter what the option, no matter what happens, it's going to take a while for everything to settle.
Yeah, at least until the third quarter of next year before the Netflix deal isn't set to happen until after the Warner Brothers Discovery business split. So that's not going to happen until the third quarter of 2026. And to clarify something you just mentioned. From what I understand, the Netflix purchasing of the Warner Brothers half of their business means that Discovery would just operate independently. They would both be publicly traded.
Yeah.
And the reason why this new Paramount news that just came out seems unlikely is that Paramount is making a slightly higher bid, but they want to purchase both. And I don't think that really works out financially.
It's technically a worse bid.
Yeah.
They're trying to offer $30 billion for everything. Whereas I think Netflix is offering 25 or 28 or something less than 30, but like I think more than $20 billion just for the Warner Brothers and that stuff. So like trying to hustle takeover Paramount means they're trying to go straight to their shareholders. They're technically offering them a worse deal.
Yeah.
But then there's a whole bunch of like political background that we probably don't need to discuss about how the government might be like in the pocket of Paramount or vice versa. And so, you know, as we said, you could talk about this forever, but there's a lot of politics and drama and bullshit going on. So I guess I think you summarized things correctly as of right now, but it's just a lot of, I don't know if I want to say chaos in the air, but uncertainty.
Yeah. And I think if the Netflix thing happens, I don't think the impact to Tsunami would be huge, again, because of the fact that Discovery is going to break off and be its own traded company. I do think there's going to be conversations that we can have in the following weeks and months. About like how does either one of these companies, Netflix or Paramount, purchasing a portion of Warner Brothers and or Discovery, how does that impact Toonami's ability to acquire things? Because I think there's a lot of interesting new things to think about there. But we're just so far from knowing the outcome of this right now. We can just sort of put the information out there and be like, well, let's just see how this is going to affect things.
And I guess it also matters for Toonami's ability to make things too, because it's the Warner Brothers part that kind of makes originals, right? And then they've kind of fed into HBO Max.
I heard that. And I don't
know. Ninja Kamui and other stuff like that.
I don't know if that's a Warner Brothers thing or an Adult Swim thing. And that's why it's unclear to me. That's where it starts to get really muddy, where it's like, okay, well, if you look at something like Primal, is Primal, I don't know if that has anything to do with Warner Brothers Television. That might simply be a Cartoon Network / Adult Swim property. So I don't know. But it could be a Warner Brothers Television thing. I don't really know. It's confusing.
Because Warner Brothers also has their own anime. Like Warner Brothers anime is a thing in Japan. So if they're buying Warner Brothers, you get that, but then that would be separated from Cartoon Network, and how does that, you don't know the answer, but I'm just kind of thinking out loud. There's kind of a lot of parts of both acquisition and also creation and stuff like that too, that's kind of not all interconnected. Just trying to unravel it kind of gets really complicated and unclear.
Yeah, so this is just really quick Wikipedia checking, but Primal's production studio is Cartoon Network Studios, which is owned by Warner Brothers Television Group.
Okay, there you
go. But they can and do go on HBO Max, so there must be an agreement in place for how those all connect, which we don't know and could get weird.
Yeah, it's the licensing here. Until someone can break it down after the purchase has occurred, we can only speculate. So that's where we are. I think people are kind of like right now kind of just in a wait and see pattern. That's where I am. And I think a lot of people, there's obviously always people out there. It's like, oh my God, it's the end of Toonami. And other people are like, this is going to be great for Toonami. And it's like, nobody knows.
I would not be surprised. Regardless if this ends up being good or bad for Toonami, and of course, there are other things to consider, but we're just a Toonami-focused podcast, of course. I would not be surprised that if this merger or whatever goes through, even once it happens, everything kind of gets frozen again for a while. Because remember, argue whether the Warner Brothers and Discovery merger was good or bad, quote-unquote, for Toonami. But either way, it happening kind of end up freezing Toonami in place for a good year before they could do anything good or bad. So
even the I think I'll end it here, but I'll say that the last thing I heard is that from the press release from the Netflix CEO, which again is that's no guarantee that they're going to get it, but if they did, even the things that they were going to acquire, like the movie studios and television studios, they said they didn't want to change how those were operating currently. And it would be a while even before those changed if they did at all. And I'm sure they would at some point, but even after the purchase, they wouldn't change immediately. So, all right. The only other piece of news I had for this week was we did get a game review this week, which was for the 2D side-scrolling platformer Ninja Gaiden Ragebound, which is a kind of modern redo of the classic Ninja Gaiden, the old-school Ninja Gaiden.
Yeah, I haven't played this game, but I heard it's, it's fun and good. Kind of as a throwback, faithful game.
It's not a remake, it's just a new entry, right?
Yeah, it's a new entry kind of in the style of the old entries, obviously without all the limitations of the NES, but...
Right. But not an actual remake of a previous
brand
game.
New game.
Okay. Yeah. I think they even mentioned in the review about this is, because there have been a lot of 3D Ninja Gaiden games that have come out, and they're this is harkening back to the original versions of the game.
Ninja Gaiden 4, the 3D one, a 3D version came out this year from Platinum, right?
Yep.
I think shortly before Gaiden died, I think it was my recollection. Rest in peace to him.
Can you guys guess what the review was?
The score? No idea.
I'll be honest, the way they were talking, I thought they were actually giving it a 9. But then I was like, oh, okay, it's just 8 anyway, all right, whatever.
Yeah.
But it sounded like you were about to give it a 9.
Yeah, he really started out the review like being like, it's great. It's really good. So, but yeah, they got an 8. That's pretty normal for them. I think a game has to completely blow them away for them to get higher than an 8.
But also, the game has to like brick their console for it to get lower than an 8 or something?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Or brick their PC?
Yeah. Or the, and then there's like a, I think there's a cutoff where if a game is not that good, they just don't review it. So that's why we always hover around an 8, I think.
Realistically, you expect to see like some 7s and 9s too, or even an occasional 10. We just don't, though.
They're very conservative in their score.
All right, and that's it for the news. So again, we've got our normal block this week of Bleach, Blue Exorcist, Mashal, and One Piece. So let's get into it. And we'll begin, of course, with Bleach. Bleach, the Thousand-Year Blood War, Core 3, Episode 2, Kill the King. Okay, I'll do our normal rundown here. Guys can speak up anytime. The episode starts out, Ichigo has a sort of vision. Now, I think this is important because it's not explained. And he just sort of is seeing things. And he even like comments on it. He's like, what was that? So not sure what that's about.
I actually don't remember this.
It may be something connected with him being part Quincy or something.
I think it was like something about the Soul King and like maybe, I think it was maybe getting brief flashes of Soul King's creation. Or
yeah, that might be it.
I think it was Soul King related, but I forget the exact details.
Yeah, now that you say that, it probably has more to do with that. Yeah, as we'll see. Meanwhile, you know, everything's shaking on all three worlds. Also, I think Ichigo mentioned in this that Hueco Mundo is like another world. I kind of forgot it was its own world.
Yeah, it's one of the three.
I guess that technically makes there's four worlds, technically. There's Soul Society, Earth. Well, no, I guess there are three, because if the Soul Society and... Yeah.
There's no Quincy world.
There's no Quincy world, and also I think there's no difference between like the upper Soul Society and the lower Soul Society. They're kind of the same world, right? Okay.
Right. I think the Quincy's live in the shadows of the Soul Society, right? That's the whole part of the whole thing.
Yeah.
Like they kind of don't have their own world. They have to live in like offshoot dimension of the Soul Society or something. That was the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. They live in the alternate like reality of the same
world. Yeah, the actual three worlds are Human World, Soul Society, and Hueco Mundo.
At least until Kubo does the hell arc, and then we'll see what happens with that.
That is interesting. I guess they don't have a hell. I thought Hueco Mundo was kind of their hell, but maybe not.
Close enough.
Oh, anyway, yeah, Kisuke's mentioning that, you know, everything is shaking. We see reaction shots from everywhere. Everybody's like, everything's shaking. And Kisuke theorizes that he's kind of like, did the keystone get removed? So we don't know what this is, but this is obviously going to be important. Then we get a really long and quite well-animated battle between Ichigo and Yuhabaha. Really, really cool. I mean, it looks great. And for a while, in true Bleach style, Ichigo is doing some damage. He's hitting Yuhabaha quite well, to the point that Yuhabaha, I think he even says he's a little impressed.
There's actually one moment in this fight that made me chuckle. I think what it was specifically was Ichigo used a Genchuga Tensho or whatever it is to like deflect an attack. And Yuhabaha says something like, Getsuga Tensho, huh? It's like, what else did you expect? That's his move. That's the one thing he does.
Yeah, didn't like Yuhabaha was like, oh, how clever.
Yeah.
How sort of like complimenting him on his like use of his one move.
His one
move. Like, he does it for everything. Attack, defense. That's what he does.
So it kind of looked like Ichigo was doing pretty well for a moment here, but we learn now that it's like, well, that's only because Yuhabaha had not activated his eye hacks yet. So he goes and activates his Sharingan. Yeah, and sure enough, it's over for Ichigo. He pretty much just, the battle completely turns in Yuhabaha's favor.
And the way that it's phrased is that when Yuhabaha is using his eyes like this, he sees everything, including like all possible futures. So he's like, you know, the way he seems to frame it is that, like, I know what's going to happen no matter what you decide to do, kind of thing.
Or, like, it counts for that, at least.
Yeah.
Yeah, it definitely is ringing of precognition now, or, you know, omniscience in a way,
right,
where he's just completely able to see everything. And so because of that, he basically is just kind of like jobbing on, I don't know if jobbing's the right term, but he's just wasting on Ichigo here. And while they're fighting, Yohavaha mentions about how the Soul King could have prevented the Quincy's from being wiped out twice, but in both times did not prevent it from happening.
Yeah, so there's a little bit of like world creation lore thrown into his little in battle speeches here, that like the Soul King is doing some sort of like balancing act to have the world balanced as it is, and whatever decision or whatever was made by the Soul King to have the world exist as it is right now, it kind of leaves the Quincy's no place in it in some fashion, and that's why Yuhabaha mm-hmm. basically wants to kill the Soul King and recreate the world in a way where the Quincy's can exist in the world. So something there. I'm probably not getting all the details right.
Yeah, I mean, Yuhabaha is obviously a piece of shit, but it is kind of true. Quincy's have been like genocided like multiple times. So they kind of have, obviously this is not an acceptable way to go about reconciling their beef, but they do have legitimate beef.
Yeah, I get this impression that, like, and I'm theorizing here, so I could be wrong, but there's a real allegory to be made here about, like, you know, the Soul King being like God, and that like the Quincy's were his angels, but then in order for him to have humans, he had to kind of do away with the angels, or like to make them lesser, or in another kind of parody, or not parody, another kind of analog, it would be like Tolkien's world with like originally there were the elves and they were immortal, but then the god of Tolkien's world created man, so the elves were kind of diminished. I get that kind of vibe from this.
Yeah, I agree. It's, you know, maybe not one to one to anything like that, or maybe not one to one, but no comparisons are. But yeah, just the Soul King, maybe, you know, that was the sacrifice, or the decision he made was, unfortunately, someone had to pull the short straw, and it would happen to be the Quincy's in that regard. And was there a better option? We don't know. We don't really understand how the world is created to begin with. I assume we'll kind of learn more about that, maybe? But, right.
I mean, this is just so SMT. Like, I'm sure, like, these thoughts running through your head, Zeta, but it's just, like,
yeah,
all about world creation, and people want to remake the world because they're tribe or whatever got drew the short straw, and somewhat like beings making sacrifices. Like, yeah, this is all, I mean, not that ST made any of this stuff. I mean, these are all like kind of based on creation myths from authoritative mythologies, but still just kind of running the whole gamut, so to speak.
So we go to the commercial break, and when we come back, we see a lot of the Soul Reapers, including Rukia and Renji and everybody else, are kind of congregating in the lab, the underground lab. And they're kind of trying to figure out what to do while the world is shaking, and to the point where the lab is kind of falling apart.
And it may be worth mentioning, and this is part of the lore came into here, a lot of these Soul Reapers, they actually asked Kisuke what was going on, and Kisuke gave some of the explanation for, like, why did the Quincy's go for the Soul King? And part of the lore that we just discussed came from kind of Kisuke. Like, he's aware of this, at least to some degree, where a lot of Soul Reapers aren't, apparently.
Interesting.
Does that make sense? Because they were, like, asking him what's going on, because they didn't know, and Kisuke at least had some idea.
Yeah, I don't know enough about Bleach to know why that would be the case, but I did pick up on the fact that, like, he knows more than most people do about most things, it seems like. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I wouldn't say Kisuke's involved in, like, the creation of the Soul Society in that sense, if that's what you're suggesting.
No.
Just more he is, or did I misunderstand?
No, he just says seems he knows to be more aware of, like, Rukia and Renji and other Soul Reapers were like, why did the Quincy's go ignore the Soul Reapers and go to the Soul King? And Kisuke was more aware, like, here's why the Quincy's went to the Soul King, and gave, I don't remember the full explanation he gave, but he's at least like, through his years of research and experiments, at least has like some insight on like reasonings for things. I'm not saying he was like part of the creation or anything. I'm just saying he's more knowledgeable. Sure. So.
Right. Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I mean, their aim is to recreate the world, not some, and like killing all the soul reapers is kind of incidental to that. So like.
Yeah, it's just that Kisuke is more knowledgeable about the world than the average soul reaper. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, pretty much.
So anyway, during the battle, Ichigo, and Yuhabaha is just like, why do you keep attacking me? This is pointless. You know I can defeat you. Why do you keep doing it? And Ichigo is just doing the typical shonen. And it's like, I don't care what you know. I'm going to try anyway. And anyway, he gets up close to the Soul King and he's able to pull the sword out. And while this is happening.
One second. So this is a small thing that I kind of appreciated. Like during this moment of futility where Ichigo no longer stands a chance, seemingly. One thing I did appreciate was Yuhabaha actually asked Ichigo, like, do you think you're the only person who can stop me? And Ichigo actually said something like, I don't know that, but I'm going to try, kind of thing. Something like that.
Yes.
And I kind of appreciated that he's like, you know, he doesn't think he's the only person who can stop Yuhabaha, even though probably that's probably true. he's just like, I'm going to try, you know, that's all I'm going to do.
But,
and yeah, during this kind of moment, then the, like the curtain like burns and that's when we see the Soul King.
Yeah. He's not so conceited.
I mean, she was here. So someone's got to do the job, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not conceited to be like, only I can do it. He's more humble than that, which is nice. But he does pull the sword out. And while he does that, right after he does that, Orihime tries to use her healing magic to kind of repair. But this is when the big moment happens in the episode. Yuhabaha, I'm not exactly sure how it happens, but he's like, everything that's transpired has led to this moment. This is the thing I've been building towards for 1,000 years, the thing I've foreseen. And that is that Ichigo, you are the one who's going to kill the Soul King, not me. And I don't know why, and I'm sure we'll learn, Ichigo does this. He takes the sword and cuts the Soul King in half, severing him completely. Everyone's shocked. We see Chad and Orihime and everybody standing by just like, what? And Yuhabaha explains that you see, only Ichigo could have done this because he is part everything.
Yep. He even says, like, you're part human, part Fulbring, which I had to look up. What is Fulbring again? Which is, like, mech.
It's the original anime.
Yeah, I remember it barely. Like, oh yeah, there's Fulbring was a thing. And, like, part Quincy, part Hollow, part human, part whatever, part everything. Like, you're the only one who could do this.
Yeah, we even got like a scene from the original anime for a moment there when he's discussing this. But yeah, so like he's like, Ichigo being there to do this was all part of the ultimate plan of Yuhabaha. And after we cut back before, that's pretty much where the episode ends in the credits. But then we have a post-credit scene where we cut back down to the Soul Society. And then Kisuke is kind of realizing he believes that the Soul King is now dead. And then he warns everybody and he says that he thinks that this is going to cause everything to cease to exist. So I really get this impression that the Soul King is like God in a way. And it's like if you kill God, then the universe is destroyed or something.
So what's going to happen is Yuhabaha is going to become God and he's going to recreate a new world. But then Ichigo is going to kill him, and then Ichigo is going to become God, and then it'll become Ichigo's world.
Oh, that would be really interesting.
I don't know. I'm just going to... I have no idea.
No, actually, I hadn't thought that far ahead. You might be right. I don't know. So, yeah, a lot happened in this episode. I mean, this is kind of the culmination of the whole Soul King part. I'm sure there's more, but, I mean, this is, like... I like this idea that, like... Because we were kind of joking several weeks ago about this idea that Ichigo is like a mongrel. He's part everything. But the fact that they work that into the story as being important is kind of neat. I like that.
It's one of the rare times where the villain letting the hero go makes like a lick of sense. Like, how much of that is Kubo planning? How much is just kind of coincidence working out that way? But obviously, this kind of question a lot of these action series of the villain can clearly kill the hero now. Why do they not do it except for the fact that, you know, plot armor or story end or whatever? Like, this is like, no, I needed you alive for this reason. So it kind of ends up working out in a well, in a logical way in that sense.
Yeah. We're only on episode 2 of this core, so it's the Soul King already being defeated is surprising. I'm really curious to see where things go from here. Is there anything else in this episode, Crocodile, that you think is important to note that I didn't catch in my notes here? Anything?
There were like a few moments of like, I remember like Yorichi kind of getting, trying to get hit in and a few other moments like that, but I don't think they're really particularly consequential. So I think you got to all the major points.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I guess my overall thoughts of this episode, that it was pretty good. I've gotten used to the Bleach turnaround, like winning, losing, winning, losing. I'm just used to that now. So him coming back here feels completely normal now. I will say that I still think Yuhavaha looks kind of derpy from a distance when you see him with his multiple pupils.
Yeah.
Oh, because he looks kind of cross-eyed or something like that?
Yeah, he looks like he's cross-eyed, yeah. But
oh, I guess anyway. I will say, like, since I won't be able to stick around for the flavor alerts, maybe it's worth the moment where Ichigo kills the Soul King because it's all part of Yuhavaha's Kikaiku. Maybe that's worth nominating for something. I'll just put that out there.
Okay. Yeah, we'll bring that back up when we get there.
I also remember, I think there was Ichibe was being like kind of weird cryptic, but like there really didn't come much of it in this episode. So I think, I don't remember if you mentioned that or not, but.
Yeah.
He said something, but I don't remember what. Kind of muttering to himself.
Something about like you can't possibly win Ichigo and something, 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 something. But yeah, I can't remember if that like actually leads to something or anywhere. It doesn't really mean, like, it's just more like cryptic shit, at least in the context of this episode.
All right, well, that'll do it for Bleach this week, so let's go ahead and move on to the next show on the block, Blue Exorcist. Blue Exorcist, Beyond the Snow Saga, Episode 5, As If Begging for Tears. So this is kind of the finale of the Shura arc. We're at Episode 5, so it's kind of like we discussed last week, where it seems like they're taking this core and kind of having two arcs in this single core.
Well, before you even get to the rundown, I was a little bit surprised because it was supposed to, Beyond the Snow Saga is supposed to be 12 episodes.
We're already beyond snow now. We're about to leave this area.
Yeah, like it seems like we wrapped up in this episode, but there's 7 more episodes of the Beyond the Snow Saga, and then we move into the whatever the other saga was. There's 12 episodes each, not 12 episodes total. So
maybe you go to another snowy area. Like there were one snowy mountain, now they go to a different snowy mountain for some other plot points.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. I kind of, because somebody in the thread, okay, I may be wrong about this, but I thought somebody in the thread said that this core was broken up into like 2 story arcs, but I thought they it meant is. Like, but see, I thought they meant that like for 12 episodes.
No, so it's 12 episodes of Beyond the Snow, and then it's 12 episodes of The Blue Knight. So it's 24 total. So that means we still have, after this, 7 more episodes of Beyond the Snow, which is like, oh, okay, that seems weird that there must be a different second conflict in this part that we haven't gotten to yet. I mean, you get hints of it. We'll talk about it.
Yeah, or maybe it's just the resolution of the whole Yukio bit now, from now on. Yeah. I don't know. Okay. Well, let's go up with the rundown here. We kind of get a flashback. We learn that, I think this was known, but we're seeing it now, that Shiro was forced to adopt Shura back when he took her as a child for the exorcists. And she was living with them. I don't think I ever really realized this until I saw this, that she was living with Shiro at the same time Shiro had adopted Rin and Yukio.
I don't know if she was living with him like full time.
Well, there was the thing that makes me think kind of, maybe not living
with him. I'm not sure if she would have anywhere else to go while she was still a child. So it's like, obviously she's several years older than the brothers. And so like they obviously kind of overlapped when she was like, I guess a teenager, yeah. They were kids. And so at some point she moved out, but I think she must have been there at least for some portion.
Well, she was, because there was a scene, that one particular scene, where we see a very, very, very young Yukio, who must be like 7 or 6 or something, come walking up to Shura, who looks like she's in her teens, and he says, "Hey, Dad wants to see you." And I would say, well, that's strange. He wouldn't say that unless she considered him Dad at the same time. So I think she was living with them.
But then there was also a scene in this episode, there was a bit of time jumping in this episode. Yes, she must have been living with them for a moment, and then maybe she went off to like to the university or the exorcist school.
I think she lived with him at least until she was probably like 16 or 17 or something, maybe, is my guess. All right. Well, anyway, we see that, and then also we do get that time skip that you're talking about, and then we see sort of a 20-year-old Shura, and she's also still hanging around. And there's this scene where she's like having a conversation with Shiro. She still sort of has like, she's like still very flirty with him to the point where she just takes her top off and like shoves his face into her chest and being like, come on, give it a shot. And of course, he's just sort of like,
being a grown man and not an anime teenager kind of shrugs it off. Like just, out, like, you know.
He probably feels a little fatherly towards her, but he literally kind of raised her to a certain extent. So this is awkward for him as well. He just takes his like exorcist priest thing off and he takes his shirt off, which is a little awkward at first. I'm like, what are you doing? But then he's just so that he could put it on her and cover her. And while he's doing this, you know, she was very kind of being very boisterous to herself. We learn that she's been like flirtatious with lots of guys apparently. And I think this is all like part of her like mindset of being like, oh, I gotta have a kid, right? That's my life's goal for Hashiro. But anyway, when he's kind of talking to her towards the end there, when he puts his shirt on her, she starts to kind of break down a little bit, and she's like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do with my life. And he's just sort of like, he's just like, all you gotta do is you just have to live. Just live. Just live your life.
He did give a little more advice, kind of like, you know, make friends, have fun, maybe start a family, kind of get a job you like. So, but the you know, grow old, the whole shebang. But the, you know, long short of it, it was like, treasure your life, live it.
Yeah, don't just live for the rule of the 30-year-old thing.
But I do think it is important that his message, while profound, is simple.
Yeah.
Like, just live. And yeah, you were just about to mention the sequeler. She's remembering this as she's like sinking to the bottom of the lake with Hachiro. Kind of, this is like the moment where she realizes, when she's remembering this moment of her past, that she has this opportunity now to do that, just live. So this is when she kind of, you know, changes her mind and decides, this is her I want to live moment, basically. Where she kind of decides, no, I'm not going to go through with this, and starts fighting back in a way.
Yeah. And this is, she's able to have this opportunity because the Exorcist brothers are here. The Okumura brothers show up. Rin is using his flames. Yukio's got his gun, and they start
she
kind of like.
She was here for some reason.
Oh, yeah, he's here too. I forgot about that. He's here. He doesn't really do much, but he's here.
I think he's really just there just to do his spy stuff.
Yes.
And be annoying.
And Rin starts using special attacks, and he has like funny names for them. And I think Yukio's giving him a hard time. And then we kind of get this brief flashback to when Shura was training Rin, and she's kind of giving him telling him about the importance of attack names. Like, you have to use attack names. But I liked how they did this in the show here, because they kind of make it like, because the exorcists have these chants that they have to do to use their magic. And he's like, attack names are just another kind of form of chanting. So, like, in the world of Blue Exorcist, to have an attack name for an exorcist kind of makes logical sense.
And she does kind of poke fun at Rin, like, well, we got to keep them simple for you, though. Not so directly, but they say that. They basically say that.
She comes up with a goofy one. It's like something, Blue Flame Campfire. And he's like, Blue Flame Campfire, that's a stupid name. What was it again? Like, he immediately forgets what it is.
I mean, I think it's clever. Like, obviously, it's kind of goofy, but it serves as a bonding moment between them. And there's actually, like, in-world, like, narrative logic to it. Like, I know this is kind of, like, a term for this, trying to, like, explain something within the context of the world. So, like, I guess just writing well, maybe? I don't know. But I don't know a specific term for this. But regardless, it is kind of narratively functions and makes sense. And I think that's to its benefit.
Yeah, it's not just... they're using the anime trope, but they're explaining it, which I like. I know the word you're thinking of, too, and I can't think of it right now at the moment. It's when, like, it's the same thing happens when they have music in a story, but then they... Oh, it's diegetic. That's the word. Diegetic is when, like, something that normally just happens for movie reasons is explained as being actually happening in the world or being part of the world. And this is kind of the same thing, where they're taking a trope, like using your attack names, but making it diegetic to the world.
I don't know if diegetic certainly works, but I think something similar to that.
So Hachiro gets mad at Shura for trying to escape, and it starts to reform its other serpent heads. So those had gotten cut off, but they already made reforms. And this is when Shura, in order to free herself from the clutches of Hachiro, does another trope in anime. She cuts her long hair, and she then rescues Yukio. And to finish off Hachiro, Rin continues to use his final move and burns and defeats Hachiro, kind of reducing Hachiro down into like a little tiny snake.
And then they let the snake get away, and they kind of explain this later, like, oh, they'll find it.
That just seems very, very like... Someone will find it. I'm not be surprised if the Illuminati find it.
Yeah, exactly. The Illuminati are looking for immortal beings, and you just let one go. So, sure.
Speaking of the Illuminati, we do see a very brief scene where Renzo is on the phone, and he's reporting in, catching someone up, I should say. We don't know who they're... He may be catching up... I think he might even be catching up Mephisto, actually.
Right. That's the thing. They're keeping it kind of like he's kind of this double spy or whatever. And, you know, he could be reporting to anybody.
I think he's like quadruple now. He's folded so many times. Don't even know which way he's going.
Shura says that she's cool with the way things are now. And she also kind of teases Yukio and Rin, but kind of treats them like a big sister. Again, I kind of get this idea that they might have lived together for a while. She's very big sisterly towards them both and gives them a hug. Backup arrives. The backup that we heard about last episode finally arrives, and they start doing exorcist-y things. And we learn that it was indeed Renzo who was the one who was spying on Yukio this whole time. That mysterious figure we saw in episode 1, it was him. And he says that he's been spying for Mephisto, actually, at least in regards to this.
Renzo says a few things. He says like he says something like, "Be careful with your suicidal experiments." Basically saying like, "Yep, that was me watching you do those." And also like, "I heard everything you were saying about taking the demon's power and the immortality and whatnot," and like, kind of like almost like aggravating Yukio on purpose. Like he's aware of Yukio's kind of insecurities and kind of badgering him there. At least it seems like it.
And Yukio's kind of putting on a strong face here. And then people are like, hey, you need to, you know, because he's got his like arm in a sling and stuff.
I wouldn't know if I would say Yukio's putting a strong, or you talking about response to what Renzo's saying? Because he looked pretty, really mad before he obviously was passed out. But I don't know if I would say Yukio was stoked when he was talking to Renzo, or do you mean outside that context?
I mean, outside it, like he's like, because people are like, hey, you know, do you need to get checked out or something, you know, the medics or something? And he's just sort of like, no, I'm fine. And then he just faints. from like his wounds, meaning that he wasn't fine.
Well, I think the Renzo revelations were really took him out mentally, and his body followed.
Fair enough. Yeah, that could be true. Anyway, fades to black, and we catch up to time. After a brief time skip, we see that Yukio is in the hospital. Rin is there. He's carving apples in the form of snakes for him. And then the Shura comes walking in with her short hair now. She explains that he's going to be out of it for 2 months. He's not going to be able to do any exorcists or even leave probably the hospital for the next 2 months. And as they leave, oh, by the way, I just want to mention briefly, I did notice, I'm not a perv, but I happened to notice that Shura doesn't have her tattoo on her chest anymore. So that is gone. And anyway, after they leave, we get a final scene with Yukio, and he unfortunately goes right back to his old ways of being like super emo and dark, and he's like angry and mad. Park
playing in the background again.
Yeah.
So we talked earlier how there's 7 more episodes left in this saga. It is called Beyond the Snow, so I guess we did the snow and now we're beyond it.
yeah.
And so I remember in the last season, Lucifer held out a hand to Yukio, basically saying, if you desire power, come to me. So will Yukio like try to escape the hospital and go to the Illuminati and cause a bunch of, you know, everything, cause a bunch of problems? So
he would almost have to escape because he's going to be out of it for 2 weeks.
Yeah, like,
right?
So if he's going to be out for 2 months and the story can't revolve around him, he's going to try to do something.
Yeah.
Because otherwise we don't have that is the conflict right now. I mean, obviously we have the larger conflict of the Illuminati just being there and everything with Renzo. But anyways, yeah, it's kind of a weird concluding ish episode of a conflict at episode 5.
Well, I feel like it wraps up Shura's arc well enough. I felt we got the little anime moment of the female character cuts her hair for character development moment. So that was a little funny. But I felt like the whole, you know, she turns on Hachiko. Or not Hachiko? Am I saying the snake guy's name right?
Hachiro.
Hachiro, there. Oh, thank you. I don't know why I was saying Hachiko. But she turns on the snake guy, kind of embraces her will to live beyond these 30 years. She has that really tender moment with the siblings, the nice hug, but that I thought that was very warm and sweet. I don't know if that's a nominatable moment, but it was a really good found family hug. I really liked it. And I think she's in a much better place. You've seen a preview of her encountering Mephisto. You can just tell she's like a different woman, and like a woman who has something to live for. A woman who definitely wants to see Rin and Yukio succeed. So at least for her and for her arc, I think we did a good job kind of wrapping that all up. Now it's just a matter of like, now we're going to go on the Yukio train and we can see how that goes, I suppose.
Yeah, I was just expecting the Shura stuff to take a little longer. Like, I was expecting this to be the most of the season and, you know, maybe be a few more wrinkles in there. But no, it kind of wrapped up pretty quickly and now we're moving on to the next kind of issue. So, not that it was bad. I'm not saying that at all. It's just from start to end, her conflict just kind of wrapped up more quickly than I thought in terms of number of episodes it took.
Yeah, like you said, I don't think we're missing anything, so I don't think this pacing is bad at all, but like I can see how coming off the Izumo arc, which was like quite a chunky bit of time, that this can be a little surprising. Like, I wouldn't necessarily expect it to be this short either for Shura, but as I think you even said, as you said yourself, we got everything we needed to get done, so this worked out fine, just maybe unexpected.
Yeah, I like the Shura arc. I enjoyed this. Also, one last thing, talking about her being a more mature woman. I do have to admit, I guess it's just the artist of the mangaka and the character designer for this show. She did very much, to me, look very boyish with her short hair. Like, when I look at her like straight on in the face, I'm like, she does kind of look like a boy. Because she was joking about that in the episode. Like, you think I look like a boy now? And when she said that, I looked at her and I thought, yeah, kind of. I mean, just her features, I think.
To be fair, I was expecting her, like, would a boy have these and just, like, puff out her chest or something? Because that feels like that would be her thing to do.
Alrighty. Well, let's move on to Mashal.
I would just say I have to head out. But for Mashal, I did want to say that I think, like, the fight between Carpaccio and Mashal, you could say it's kind of cliche in a sense, like, oh, you're just overloading his power and that's how you win. It's a very common kind of battle plan for a lot of, series and whatnot. I still enjoyed the fight quite a bit. How everyone reacted if their face is getting smaller and smaller is pretty funny. I think Finch stood his ground well, even though it was hopelessly overpowered. I enjoyed the episode, and I enjoyed that fight, and I think that's, a nominatable fight. I think it was a good, you can say cliche in some respects, but I think it was a good and enjoyable fight, nonetheless, between Mashal and Carpaccio.
Gotcha. Cool. So,
that, I gotta head out, so see you guys later.
Alrighty. Thanks.
Take care.
Okay, let's get into Mashal. Mashal, Season 2, Episode 5, Finn Ames and the Friend. First thing that happens is we get like a sort of pre-episode explanation about the fact that there are these 13 ancient wands that are the most powerful wands in the world. They're called the Master Canes. And this is important because we're going to learn later in the episode that Carpaccio has one of these Master Canes.
Yeah, I think this is the first time this phrasing has been used. I know for the divine visionaries, they call them like the cane of something or whatever, cane of whatever element. But I think this is the first time they've used the phrase Master Cane. So,
you're right that I kind of forgot about that, that the divine visionaries were called canes. Interesting.
Yeah. Like Rain Ames is called the Sword Cane. Now, does that mean he has like a sword Master Cane? I don't know.
Kind of feels like
We haven't really used this Master Cane phrasing before, I don't think. Maybe I missed it, but...
No. I'm completely with you. I think this idea of Master Canes is being introduced now, but they did call them canes. They called the people canes before. Now, his magic does involve swords. I think that the idea here being is that he's a divine visionary. He very likely has a Master Cane that involves swords.
Yeah, that seems likely also. I just don't know if they've ever really said that explicitly, that like his wand is special.
Another thing that kind of backs that up too is that we learn in this episode through Finn, and I think this has been explained before, but I kind of forgot about it, that people have like general magic and then they have what's called personal magic. And yeah. I would assume that like Carpaccio, for example, has his own personal magic, but when he's using his Master Cane, that's different. That's like the cane's magic. So, all right. We cut to the exam, and it turns out everyone has been forced to split up. So, unfortunately, Finn is by himself. He comes across Carpaccio dueling or, battling with this other contestant. It's like a no name.
Yeah, just some nameless guy.
Yeah. And this is when it's revealed what Carpaccio's, this might be his personal, well, actually, I don't know. No, it isn't. This is his cane, I think. Anyway, he's stabbing himself with a knife, but when he does it, he doesn't get damaged. It's his opponent.
And yeah, there's a few things here that there maybe aren't explained overall. Like throughout the episode, Carpaccio mentions how he's like never felt pain ever since he was a baby. So this isn't like an ability he developed. It's just like an ability he's always had. And like, how does he like obtain a Master Cane? Does it just like manifest in with him somehow? It doesn't really explain this directly, I think, but he somehow has it. But yeah, he mentioned that he's never ever felt pain.
That's a good point. Like, if it is the cane that's making this possible, which I get the impression it might be, then he must have been given that at a very, very young age. So, yeah, I don't know.
Well, I assume we'll get more details on how these canes work when they introduce more of them, I assume.
Yeah, I think that we're going to see more of them. You're right. Well, Finn realizes right away, of course, that he's no match for this guy. And so he tries to become one with the wall. He tries to become a wall, which just means he's hiding. Unfortunately, it doesn't work. Carpaccio is right there and sees him. And this is when Finn uses his personal magic. He's been deliberately holding off, showing it off. He didn't want anyone to know what his magic was so that he could use it to surprise his opponents. And this is his last stake. He's at his end of his rope. He has to use it. And what it is his personal magic allows him to basically, he basically does what Law does in One Piece. He allows him to change two objects' positions. So he swaps Carpaccio with the dead guy.
And he uses this to like get a head start on running away. But it doesn't really
work. It doesn't work for the main reason being that he really only moved that guy about 50 feet.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate. So he ends up getting stabbed. And by that, of course, I mean Carpaccio is stabbing himself and it's knocking Finn down. But nonetheless, we get like Finn has this very dramatic moment here where he's like, you know, Carpaccio's just like, why are you even trying? You're so beneath me. This is pointless. Just give me your crystal and I'll let you stop suffering and all this kind of stuff. But Finn's like, no, I can't do that. If I do that, then Mash won't be able to, you know, become a divine visionary and ultimately stay alive. He's my friend. I have to do this for my friend.
Yeah, so it's very selfless. It's not necessarily like a groundbreaking moment, like we've seen these sorts of scenes before, but, you know, Finn is not giving in. Very selfless. He's kind of thinking about Mash as he's doing this. So,
yeah, I think Carpaccio is even like, why are you even here? Is it just because, you know, you have a famous brother? You've always been weaker. And, it's kind of nice that, like, it's both nice and not nice that, like, Finn is just sort of like realizing it's like, I just can't beat this guy, but I'm still going to try my hardest regardless. But it's like kind of sad that, you know, Finn can't do anything here. He's just kind of powerless.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. Like, I wish he had more agency, but what we are getting is his character, like what he believes in. So, you know, I'm hoping the longer that match goes on that Finn eventually gets to actually do something. But in this moment, and Mash even kind of talks about this in his sort of talk no jutsu moment. He kind of mentions that, like, in their beliefs or in their, I guess, willpower, Finn has, like, higher, more willpower than Carpaccio does, especially when Carpaccio starts to feel pain.
So as right about the time that Finn is about to give up, that's when Mash comes running in to save Finn and gives Carpaccio a huge punch that knocks him into a wall. He smashes him, and then that's when the commercial happens. When we come back to the commercial, you know, Mash starts punching the crap out of Carpaccio, but of course, every attack on him is just reflected back at Mash. So this is kind of cool in a way because I'm thinking like, Mash is so strong. Like, nobody can punch Mash like Mash. So he's like hitting himself like with the hardest punches. You know what I mean?
Like, nobody can defeat Mash, but maybe Mash can defeat Mash.
Right. Yeah. I'm kind of thinking it's like, man, these must really hurt him because it's his punches.
Yeah. And, you know, at this point in the episode, Finn does a little bit of the I guess play by play. But so does the audience in the crowd. They can see this through the little mirror thing. But Mash, you know, he attacks a few times, gets hit back a few times, but that doesn't like stop him at all. In fact, he just starts punching faster and more. And that's actually a big chunk of this part of the episode is that Mash just basically just keeps punching as fast as he possibly can. He's feeling every single one of these. And Carpaccio even mentioned something along the line, like, are you trying to like outpace the regeneration of the goddess statue, which is like his ability? And actually sort of seems to show like almost yes, like the goddess statue is starting to crack.
Exactly. So, yeah, I didn't explain that. Like, when he uses this magic, like, he has a second form of this magic where a giant, like, goddess statue appears behind him that represents the healing power. And yeah, you're right. He's punching so fast that the magic of the statue can't keep up, can't regenerate fast enough, and you see it cracking. And then at the point you think the statue is about to break, it becomes like even a like more powerful, and it starts attacking more, and it starts throwing like giant syringes down at him.
Yeah.
Oh, and we see his master cane, which is like this weird looking cane that has like a literal human heart. Yeah, that's beating.
Yep, and somewhere around here, Mash pulls out his iron rod.
Yes, this is exactly when this happens. So, you know, he's dodging all the attacks from the new powered up goddess statue, but then he's got his own wand. So he pulls out that weird wand he picked up a couple episodes ago. And I was so curious what he's going to do with it, but he does something I never expected. With his fingertips, he just stretches it and changes its shape into that of a tennis racket. And I can't tell if, like, there's magic involved there or if it's just literally him bending metal.
I think it's just him bending metal and
I think so
with
too.
His fingers.
Yeah, it must be. I don't know if there's anything to that rod. Because I was starting to think in this moment, I was like, is that a master cane?
Yeah, is this like million ton rod or whatever it is its own master cane that he just picked up off the floor? I don't know.
I think it could
just
be
an iron. Yeah, it seems like it's not a normal object, because why? What else could weight be that heavy? But it could also just be a joke that it's just a stupid heavy rod.
Well, I don't think. See, but I remember that guy in the cane shop calling it a cane, and he would know. Yeah. So I think it is. I think he's going to have a master cane and never be able to use it like the way it's supposed to be used as a joke, I think. I don't know.
Yeah,
anyway,
it could be either.
He uses the tennis racket to smash the attacks back at the statue, and he ultimately breaks it. And this dispels the sort of, you know, reflection magic. And this is when Mash is like, so you've never felt any pain in your life? Well, let me show you. And he just punches the living crap out of him. And he just falls to the ground, blood coming out of his face.
I think specifically what it is, he grabs his racket with two hands and like pulls it straight above his head and like just swings it kind of straight down as an arc.
Oh, right.
Top of his head, like a bonk, like a really heavy Mash bonk.
Yeah.
And that's when Carpaccio makes his first like sound of pain, like, you know, an effort. That's when he gets hit and actually feels it.
He's like, this is what pain is. He actually starts doing a little bit of like, I think this show likes to have its villains turn good. And I get a very small inkling here of him like being like, is this what it feels like every time I hurt someone? Oh, man, this is horrible.
And then this is when Mash starts doing his kind of Mash no jutsu, where he is basically like, this pain you're feeling now, like kind of comparing it to the pain that Finn was feeling earlier. Like Finn was able to, you know, withstand the pain that he was feeling to hold on to his, what he believed in, blah, 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 blah. And you wouldn't be able to do that kind of thing. Basically kind of saying that Finn is actually better than you.
Yeah.
In this way, in this framing. So.
And he thanks Finn. He's like, thank you for holding out for me. You were very strong for doing that. Yeah. Yeah, Mash is, if anything, very appreciative of the people that are helping him, which is nice. Because it's very, it's nice because he's so, like, his mannerisms, you would think he would come across as a character who's sort of so blasé that he doesn't care about anything going on. But he is also very perceptive of the good people around him.
Right, definitely.
By the way, Mash no Jutsu is pretty great. Yeah, and that's it for the episode. So, yeah, I guess I don't think this particular round is over. I think he just rescued Finn at the end.
Yeah, so I think you skipped over this earlier. I forget if this was at the end of the last episode or the beginning of this one, but each team has three crystals, but Mash's team broke two of them immediately. So it's, they just have the one, but like they're still like like, for example, Lance is on a different team, and their team still has a couple of crystals, maybe two. And like, they have to solve that, right? Like, how, if they're gonna conflict against Lance about, like, you know, you're in our dorm or whatever, but we can't let you win this team battle kind of thing.
I agree. I think that, I don't think that Lance is going to make it. I mean, Mash obviously has to win. So yeah, I don't know.
Right. I think that seems like a sensible place for the next episode to go.
Yeah, exactly. So that's it for this episode. I mean, Carpaccio was kind of done out in two episodes, so that's not bad.
It was really more, it was kind of just, it was more of like a Finn moment, even though Mashal took over. It was a good episode. I liked it. I think it was creative with the power and what Mash could do to counter the power. You know, it was kind of heartwarming, the friendship that Mash and Finn have that we've seen over the last couple of episodes. It gave it a little bit of substance versus just, you know, it's just that guy who hangs out with Mash type of thing. So,
by the way, before we move on to the final show, I do want to mention this. And I was, when they aired the opening this week, I noticed something in the opening that I kind of don't want to mention because I feel like it's a spoiler, but it involves the Dumbledore character.
Oh.
So tell me if you want to know what I saw or not.
Well, so I know the opening has a lot of like transitions and it like does like this kind of like rotating effect, or it rotates against through different faces. So I'm wondering if like what face it rotates before or after the Dumbledore face. I'm trying to remember. So if that clues you in on something, I don't know.
Well, there's something that was shown that I think is a spoiler. It's not a big spoiler.
Oh, okay. His eye, his lines.
I won't mention anything more. You can watch it next time. You'll see it, I think.
Yeah, that's the thing with openings, is not only when you're watching like a show, you see the opening more than once and you obviously start to clue in like, oh, this part's showing this thing and this part's showing this thing that I'm seeing in the show. But as you watch it more and more, you start to notice those other maybe hidden details about things that, because obviously when they're making these openings, these manga are already written and they can, you know, throw that into the opening, however creatively.
That's the point of an opening. I don't think every opening has to do this, but being a sort of like preview of what you're going to see makes sense a lot of times. And that's kind of, there's a little bit of that in here for sure. Because we also saw in the opening, we see both the music guy and we also see the Carpaccio stabbing himself in the opening.
Yeah.
So we've seen that now as well. So. All right. Well, that's it. I agree. It was a pretty good episode of Mashal. Mostly Finn related, but yeah, it's pretty good. Let's move on to the final show of the premiere of the block, which is One Piece. One Piece episode 755, Garchu, the Straw Hats reunite. We see it's going to be a rainruption, which is explained that the giant elephant puts its trunk up into the air and shoots water all over the kingdom of Zoe.
This is a very dangerous kingdom for devil fruit users.
You know, that's true. I didn't think I really picked up on that until this rewatch on this episode,
because like Luffy can handle rain, just normal rain, no problem, but if it's salt water from the sea or any devil fruit user, not just Luffy, but
then
it's a problem.
Yeah, so much so that, like, you know, it's explained that this happens twice daily, and then like it's so much water that it's like a tsunami.
Wait, I'm actually thinking now, like, in this episode, does it show, like, Law or Robin, like, getting wet? Like, are they affected? Like,
well, I think Robin said something about getting to higher ground, so I kind of got the impression they just got up on top of the roofs. I think that's what happened. I think they got up on the rooftops. Could we see Usopp later on a rooftop?
Yeah.
But yes, the wave comes and it knocks Luffy off of the giant alligator thing and he is drowning. And Carrot quickly jumps and goes and rescues him. There was like a shark, like a normal shark that yeah. trying to eat Luffy, but she like defeats that and saves Luffy.
It was like a very cartoony shark, almost like.
Yeah.
I feel like I've seen this shark in other cartoons. They're like, yep, that's what a cartoon shark looks like.
He looked a bit like that giant shark from Fishman Island. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Kind of looked a lot like that. Yeah. But normal size. Oh, but by the way, this whole sequence was really well animated, too. Like, this is a Sakuga moment for sure.
And by the way, like, Carrot hasn't been able to do a lot of things yet. And even though I kind of know from Osmosis that she becomes more and more important, like, I kind of like her vibe early on. She's just kind of like the helpful, you know, upbeat sidekick right now as she is to the dog lady. But, you know, so far, like, I was actually kind of expecting her to, like, annoy me.
Wait, say that again? You cut out a little bit.
I was sort of expecting Carrot to be annoying for some reason, but so far she just
Okay. Yeah, I would not consider her annoying. I think she can be troublesome, but annoying, no. She's a sweetheart. Like I said, I think that people in the thread have been kind of talking about, oh, wow, you know, this Zoe already looks way better than Dressrosa animation style-wise. And I agree to a certain extent, but I think it's very hit and miss. I think, like, sequences like this are very heavy Sakuga, but then there are also moments in this episode that don't look any better than Dressrosa ever did. So it kind of fluctuates a lot. Meanwhile, we see that Kanjiro has decided to draw yet another hopeless creature to ferry both him and Kinemon back up on the elephant. This time it's a poorly drawn cat.
And there's the monkey is with them?
Yes, the monkey that fell down is still with them. He even says something.
Yeah, it said something. And that's when I realized, like, oh, the monkey's with them, and they're all trying to get back up. Okay. So who threw the monkey off? Like, did he jump off? Did he get thrown off?
I don't remember. I don't remember. I don't know if it's been explained or if it is explained. I don't remember. It might be explained, actually.
So that's my number one question right now, is what's up with the monkey?
Well, the thing is, I wasn't entirely sure. I guess I should have been. Is he a mink? And then I was like, oh, yeah, he's a mink because he talks.
I guess but so.
He looks so much like a normal monkey. I wasn't sure, you know. In fact, I'm pretty sure this guy has a name that we learn later. So anyway, they're trying to make their way up. This poor cat is, you know, it's got stubby legs just like Rinosuke. And yeah, here comes the rain eruption water. So they just get washed back off again. So. I don't think they die. No, actually, I know they don't die. But I mean, like, they just got hit with ocean water and they're heading back down to the ocean. Probably should die, but I don't think they do. All right. Back up on land, or it's not land, it's elephant back. We see that the water is now receding. We also kind of see how it's kind of neat how, like, the city was designed to be like a giant aquifer.
Yeah, they basically explain in this moment how they kind of all realize, along with the audience, like, oh, this rain eruption event happens regularly. It's not just rain. It's, you know, water that's been snouted up. And obviously any civilization in this area would have to account for that. So, you know, the city has these, you know, aqueducts and pathways for the water to funnel as it gets, you know, drained. And I guess this happens twice a day or whatever.
Yeah, it, like, filters the water so it's drinkable, but then it also, like, brings fish with it so they have fresh fish all the time. That's how they sustain themselves. It's pretty neat.
Small thing, but there's one of the things that Robin says is she's, like, partially kind of, like, realizing and explaining what's going on, and she has, like a drawing in her head of what the elephant looks like as it snouts up water, and it's, like, overly cute.
Yes.
So that's how she envisions the elephant.
And somebody in our group watch thread was kind of like, Oda's pretty good at world building. And I'm like, yeah, this is another good example of that. I think thinking about how this society would function on the back of an elephant. So anyway, we see the waters also receding in the forest. And this is when Wanda and Carrot kind of mentioned two things that I think are important to mention. Wanda mentions Zunisha, And then she also mentions that they're going to meet up with Cat Viper. Now, I don't know if it's, I think it's made clear enough here, I'll just say it, that Zunisha is the name of the elephant.
Okay.
Because I think she says something like, Zunisha does this twice a day.
Yeah.
Something like that.
It helps for me to see it spelled out.
Oh, yeah, because it's a weird name.
Yeah.
And they says that we need to meet up with our leader, Cat Viper. So we'll eventually meet them.
There's also a point roughly around here where Carrot just kind of nibbles on Luffy's ear.
Yes, this is that moment right now. We cut over, we see that Usopp and the other team are on top of the buildings over back at the city, and Usopp uses his glasses, which are kind of binoculars, and he sees them all riding, Luffy and them riding nearby, and she's like, he's like, oh my god, Luffy's being eaten by one of those monsters! But it's just Carrot just nibbling on Luffy's ear.
Yeah, I just kind of think of it as like, okay, they're kind of animals, and, you know, like, a kitten might do this, or
yes,
whatever. So, you know, and like the Wanda, like a few times has licked him.
Yeah.
And like, okay, like a dog might do that. Like, sure. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. The minx, and we see this a little bit later in the episode too, when we catch up with Nami, the minx are very affectionate and like to nuzzle you and, you know, and lick you and bite you and stuff.
Yeah,
that's kind of how
I saw it. And, you know, like they're animals, and it's like, yeah, like what a cat or a dog might do, and they're literally animals. So
yeah,
so I didn't take much more away from it than that.
Yeah, I think, yeah, it's just a joke that like Usopp sees Carrot biting Luffy and being like, oh my god, but it's really just like a nibble.
And there's actually there's a running joke throughout this episode that like the minks are cannibals.
That was last episode, but yes, it's still here.
I think it brought into this episode also.
Okay.
So,
yeah, well, you're right. Cause like, I think you're right. Usopp's like confirming it. He's like, you're right, Robin. They are cannibals.
When was the scene where there's like a cutaway of like Robin with like, where it turned the whole like frame red and she's like cannibals.
Well, that was last episode.
Okay.
Yeah, that's when the joke began with her being like, they must be cannibals, because they mentioned you need to go find your friend's corpse.
Yeah.
And that's when Robin's like, oh, maybe they're cannibals. And she does that like three times in that episode, and every time Usopp gets freaked out. Anyway, they're walking through, and they sort of see this like torture rack that's got like blood on it and stuff. As Luffy, Wanda, and Carrot are riding, and you sort of like get this, I don't know, post-traumatic like flashback from Wanda about, she's thinking back to when Jack attacked.
Mm-hmm.
And she says that she's heard that since then, Jack has been defeated and that his body was never recovered. But I think defeated by like Navy ships. So
they say Sengoku and Fujitora, right?
Yeah, Fujitora, yeah.
They say they said like an admiral and a former Navy admiral, like, or a former Navy Supreme Admiral, whatever Sengoku's position was.
Right. But they also make a point that his body was never recovered, which is, mm-hmm. I mean, take it. What do you think? He's never recovered.
I think that means he's dead and won't show up again.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. All right. That's when they get the commercial break. When we come back, they're still riding on this alligator thing, which we learn has a name. It's called a Wani, and they're on their way to the right flank. And as they're riding there, suddenly the rest of the people that were in the city suddenly appear, because Law has used his shambles ability to like teleport them right in front of Luffy. So these guys are kind of reunited now. However, Usopp is still freaking out because he believes that Carrot and Wanda are dangerous. So he sort of like puppets Zoro.
Yeah.
And he's like, put them down or I'll kill you, or what, something.
I don't think anyone's falling for this.
No. I did like the Sunny Stray, right?
Yeah, that's Usopp's voice actor.
Okay, yeah. He's doing a great job here.
I'm sure that Sunny Stray and Chris Abbott are like really good friends, because they've worked with each other for like 20 years. So like,
oh,
it must be fun. It must be fun to be like, hey, you need to try to imitate Chris Sabat for these lines.
Yeah.
That's probably fun.
But like an over-the-top like
right
version.
Like obviously not Chris Sabat, but
yeah. That's great. But, you know, it's kind of revealed that, like, I don't know if it's Luffy or somebody. He's like, no, they're good. They're nice. They're good people.
But then
don't worry
about
it. But
Wanda, is that her name? Yeah, Wanda, like, points at their gate and there's, like, guards there. And then they're like, let's head in kind of thing.
Yeah. The guards are kind of like, first, they're really mean looking. And they're like, we don't want these outsiders. What are you doing? You're not supposed to be, you're not supposed to be with these outsiders. And Wanda's like, oh no, you don't understand. This is Straw Hat Luffy and his crew. Remember the Straw Hat, that our saviors, is what she says. And they're like, suddenly like, oh, really happy to see them. Meanwhile, we cut briefly inside the fortress, and we see a giant sheep laying on the ground. And on top of this giant sheep is Nami, who has been sleeping. And Chopper's
there
running
also.
In. Yes.
So Nami is wearing like a dress, like a cocktail type dress. And Chopper's also in like a new outfit also.
Yes.
But this whole scene is kind of giving me like Return of the Jedi vibes with the Ewoks.
It totally is, isn't it? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, where like the visitors are now like the saviors. They're not being treated like gods or whatever. I mean, almost. Saviors, at least.
Well, also, there's another thing, too, because we see their village in a few minutes, too, and it is very Ewok-like.
Yeah.
They're like they look like giant pineapples that are, like, hanging in the trees and stuff. That's their houses and stuff. So it's like, yeah, I never put that together.
That's what came to mind when I was watching it.
Chopper comes running in, and it's like, Luffy and the others are here. They're finally here.
Yeah, everyone's happy.
And we see, like, the whole, like, Mink Kingdom kind of coming outside and welcoming them and like cheering for them, and they're like, oh, this is great, and they start all shouting Garchu, Garchu,
and then Luffy even mentions like, I don't know what that means, but Garchu,
Garchu or whatever.
Well, yeah, and I see in your notes here they do talk about how like basically the minks see the humans as just lesser minks.
Yes, they're hairless minks to them. Yeah, because they're like, don't you hate humans? I think is what somebody says. And they're like, you're just another mink to us.
They don't say this like explicitly or with any sort of like malice, but they almost see themselves as like, you know, we're actually a superior race to humans. They don't say it that directly, but they pretty much imply like, yeah, we're a full minx and you're a partial minx or a lesser minx.
Yeah, they literally call them lesser minks. And it's like, to us, you're just like... a monkey mink is just, you just don't have much fur.
Yeah, you're missing your fur for some reason. How weird.
And Nami and Chopper come running towards them. And Nami, like I said earlier, she's on her way to go, like, meet them and greet them. And that's a whole bunch of, like, minks are kind of, like, stopping her to give her nuzzles and saying Garchu and being like, aren't you happy? And Nami, they're here. And she's like, yes, I gotta go. And then she kind of breaks free. But as she runs up to Luffy
even explicitly says something like, Brooke and Sanji are around too, right?
Oh, yes. And that's when she like hugs him really tightly and then pulls back, and you see that she's crying and that she says, Sanji is gone.
But what about Brooke?
Yeah, what about Brooke?
Yeah, so we clearly have Nami and Chopper. Brooke was with them. He is no longer with them, apparently. Maybe... I don't know. Maybe they buried him thinking he was dead. and then I guess Momonosuke has to be somewhere too, right?
Yeah, Momonosuke.
Am I missing anyone?
And then Sanji.
Oh, and and Sanji, and I guess Caesar.
Oh yeah, that's a good point. Yes, Caesar is also should be here, but not there.
I think it was the last couple of episodes. Even Luffy was like, Nami, Chopper, Momonosuke, Brook, and Gas Guy. I don't care about Gas Guy.
Yes, I like that too. But yeah, we're only seeing Nami and Chopper here. We're missing a bunch of people. So, but Sanji's gone.
Yep, he's gone.
He must be the corpse they heard about, right?
Yeah, probably. He's dead. They have to kill They have to kill one of the Straw Hats. This is it.
So that is it, Garchu. What'd you think about this episode?
I mean, start of the arc. I interesting location that we're in. More like foresty than like the more like Spanish nation of Dressrosa. I know we had like the there's a little bit with like the what are the little guys called?
Tentatas?
Dressrosa arc. Yeah, the Tentata, like, forest, like, fairy forest, but, you know, more, like, jungly. Got the Minx, meeting new characters, and obviously we're about to hear something happen that needs to be solved with Sanji. So, I'm interested.
Yeah.
Seeing what's up. Who is this Jack guy? Who is this, like, I don't think we've met Cat Viper yet. What's up with him or her? I'm curious.
Cool. Yep. I continue to, this is my first time rewatching Zoe, and I'm kind of enjoying it more than I thought I would. So it's pretty good.
So we know that Sanji's, that group was on the run from like the Big Mom pirates. And I know they come into play, and more importantly later, but I'm kind of, you know, I'm assuming Nami will explain kind of what happened in the next episode. I mean, that seems obvious. So we'll see what happened, and there'll have to be some mission that Luffy and crew will have to take on to save Sanji or, you know, solve the problems of this kingdom and see what happens here. And I know this arc isn't as long, so I'm assuming things will get moving pretty fast.
I think, again, this is a shorter arc. It's only about 29 episodes or so. So, yeah, things will be moving. I think the pacing here ought to be pretty good, so. All right, well, that is it for the rundown. Do we want to talk about flavor alerts?
Play flavor alert.
Potential award nominations.
Let's see.
Crocodile did mention he thought that maybe...
He thought Ichigo killing the Soul King.
Yeah, Ichigo killing the Soul King might be a moment.
Let me, I'm scrolling up. Where is our flavor alerts? Here we are. We have quite a few moments already. Do we have any Bleach moments? We do not have any Bleach moments. So.
Okay. Well, I can go ahead and add that. He called it the Soul King Keikaku. Let's go with that. Yeah, I still wish we had more worse moments. Maybe when it gets closer to the end of the year, we can put out a request for people to be like, what's a good worst moment? We don't have very many.
Best name, Carrot.
Okay. We can do that.
It's just a simple name. Can't forget it because she's a rabbit. Kind of rolls off the tongue, like Carrot. It's easy to say. I don't know. It's not like a funny name or an amusing name. It's just like a simple, easy, good name for a rabbit character. They're just Carrot.
Yep. He also mentioned maybe having in Best Fight the Mask versus Carpaccio.
I think so.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I thought that was a more interesting fight for Mask, considering he was kind of fighting himself.
And the animation was pretty good, especially when he like pulled out the racket. Not excellent. Like, it probably wasn't as good as, like, the Bleach stuff that we saw. Not as good as that, but it was pretty good.
Yeah. looking here at the other categories, I don't think that Carpaccio's ability is all that interesting. I think I've seen this in other shows.
Yeah, we have.
Yeah.
No voice acting performances were amazing. Anything in Blue Exorcist, like...
I mean, is Shura a good is she a character nominatable character, do you think, or what do you think about her character? I mean I like her character, but I don't know if it's like a really great character.
I unfortunately feel like she didn't have a lot of agency in this episode.
Agreed.
Like as soon as she decides to live her life, she gets like captured up in like one of the tongues, and then later on she does like free herself.
Well, she frees herself and helps Yukio, but she doesn't defeat Hachiro.
But then Rin just immediately comes in and does the defeat. So like,
yeah,
she doesn't get saved. Like, she kind of saves herself, which is good. But then it's a little bit muted.
I don't think I'm ready to put it there. I would say, yeah. I like her character, but it's not nominatable.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, Izumo had way more catharsis with her story, I think.
Yeah, and we'll see where they go with Shura. But just if she had like freed herself, maybe saved Rin or saved Yukio. I guess she did save Yukio, but like she saved Yukio, then immediately Rin kind of takes like the glory. I don't know. If she'd done a little bit more, maybe, but unfortunately, I feel like.
Yeah. We haven't really gotten a villain yet in this arc of One Piece. It's too soon for that. I don't think that the snake guy...
Yeah, Hachiro is not best villain.
No, he's not.
He kind of got. I don't think he's like worst character either necessarily. He just kind of like, oh, he was. I thought he might be more significant than he ended up being, but he seems to be out of the picture. Who knows? They might capture that.
Well, I think he is. I think he's. Yeah, I think
they
he's
might
defeated.
Capture that snake and see what. I don't know. That'll happen. I doubt him as a character will exist, but.
Right. And I think that, like, I said last episode that, like, I feel like it's not nominatable, but I did like that they at least gave him some emotion. Like, the fact that he was in love and stuff, like, that was more than I was expecting from this generic guy. So it was, like, better than generic, but it's not amazing. So, okay. I got a couple in here.
Anyway, so we added Carrot and then Mash versus Carpaccio.
Yeah. And the Soul King Kekkaku.
Oh, and the Soul King moment, yep.
Which I agree. I don't know if that's going to win, but I like the idea that they woven in Ichigo being a mongrel into the story as a being part of someone's plan. I like that. All right. Well, that will do it for this episode of the Toonami Escape Podcast. Thank you very much for being here, Seda.
Yep, my pleasure.
And thanks, Crocodile, for being here earlier. We should be back this next weekend, or the next week. I think we just have a normal lineup. We are getting close to the holidays, so we're going to have to see what happens there eventually. But they haven't announced anything, so I'm sure there'll be some kind of marathon. But until then, we will see you next week. So, later.
Later.